Bonjour tout le monde, bon matin. Le soleil est de retour avec nous, ça fait du bien. Si tout va bien, on va pouvoir luncher à l'extérieur ce midi, sur les tables à pique-nique, tout ça, ça va être plus sympathique qu'hier. So, good morning everybody. Today the sun is back with us and so we should probably be able to have lunch outside, almost like a picnic. I have a few announcements to make before our director, the director of the Douglas Institute, speaks a few words to you. I just want to remind people: those of you who want CME credits need to sign after each session. If you have missed signing for some sessions, you can go to the front desk and let them know. I also would like to remind you that in the little folder that we gave you, there are evaluation forms for the sessions. This is, as you know, tremendously important for us. We need to know which session worked and which did not work so well. I also would like to remind you that the bookstore is open. For those of you who are presenting a poster, I suggest that you install it between 9:30 and 10. That's the best time. And I apologize if you have to miss a little bit of the talks. I also want to remind everybody that Workshop L is going to be partly in French. And there will be no simultaneous translation of the French parts of that workshop. So let me now greet Jacques and Litz from the Douglas Institute.
Thank you, Alain. Merci. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Bonjour, mesdames et messieurs. Mon nom est Jacques Andlis, and I am the Director General of the Douglas Mental Health University Institute. And it's my pleasure to welcome you on this, the second day of the International Conference on the Use of Internet in Mental Health. I think you'll agree with me that this conference has already been terrific. Discussions about the prevalence of the Internet in everyday life have been stimulating and almost as interesting as learning how individuals interact in the virtual reality site, Second Life. I am confident that the rest of this unique conference will leave us with equally inspiring impressions. This morning, as I was talking to Alain, we were talking about some of the conflicts our people have had in attending this conference because Quebec is organizing itself in terms of the potential pandemic for H1N1. And we were talking about the use of the Internet in dealing with this pandemic. And the fact that without the Internet, this would be a very, very different way of being managed. Right now, we have public health in Quebec City, which is roughly 300 kilometers away, who is managing this. Messages are going out on a daily basis through the Internet to our 18 different regions. From these regions, they are going out to each one of the centers in Montreal, and they are being kept up to date on a daily basis with feedback going back to them. But it can be increased to an hourly basis. Messages are consistent. Approaches are consistent. Handling of media and handling of potential crises is consistent. It's quite amazing. We've gone through other kinds of scares like this, certainly not anywhere well as managed as it is here today because of just our use of the Internet. So here's an application in everyday life, which is happening right now here, and it's probably happening all over the world too. So we are proud to welcome such a diverse group and delighted to have assembled world-renowned lecturers, sociologists, philosophers, clinicians, and researchers from the Douglas Institute. This is truly an international meeting, and you will be interested to know more than a dozen countries are being represented here today. We are pioneers of Internet use at the Douglas Institute. One example is the work of Michel Perrault, who has conducted psychosocial research using the Internet as a research tool. In addition, many of you are now familiar with Alain Brumain's Infotrauma.org site, showing the power of the internet for distribution of mental health knowledge. The Douglas Institute has also been in the forefront of using Web 2.0 and various social media strategies to bring awareness and education to the general public about mental health issues. This conference will also include a NATO Advanced Research Workshop, which will begin this afternoon. The theme of this session is, how can the internet help after a traumatic event? David Spiegel, the Wilson Professor in the School of Medicine and Associate Chair of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University, will inaugurate the workshop with a lecture on internet working after trauma. Dr. Spiegel has won many awards, including being named a Distinguished Life Fellow by the American Psychiatric Association in 2006, and this promises to be an excellent and invigorating session. So, I wish you all a good day. Je vous souhaite tous une bonne journée et je vous retourne à Alain Brunet. Merci bien.
All right. Well, it's my pleasure to introduce this morning's speaker, Ellen Christensen, the director of the Center for Mental Health at the Australian National University, and Gerhard Andersen, professor of clinical psychology at Unkoping University in Sweden. Dr. Christensen's interests include the prevention of depression and anxiety disorders, the use of internet and other technologies for health promotion, health and e-mental health policy, the self-management of disease, and changes in cognitive processes such as memory, intelligence, and intelligence with age. Today she will be discussing how to prevent mental health disorders through the internet.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Today, just disclose my interests and to acknowledge all the people that I work with at the Centre for Mental Health Research, particularly Kathy Griffiths and other members of our team who have been instrumental in developing these applications and doing the research with me over the last 10 years. Now, today what I wanted to do was actually put forward an argument to you, which is that the internet is both an effective and feasible platform to deliver prevention programs. And this really consists of two main points I want to make. The first is that prevention approaches, mainly non-web-based prevention approaches, are effective. And although there are enormous difficulties in actually doing prevention research properly, I think the evidence now suggests that prevention can work. So given that prevention can work, the next part of my argument really is that prevention at a population level is feasible using web platforms. Indeed, you could even go another step forward and say, without web platforms, we can't really do public health prevention. And this conclusion is based on evidence that I'll present about the direct and indirect evidence for the effectiveness of automated web in prevention, and then combined with the unique features of the web in terms of dissemination, engagement, and other features. And I'm going to demonstrate these points with respect to a youth focus today, because that's an area that I've recently become very interested in, and also use examples from our research. So, as I said before, this argument's based on an approach to youth and using youth evidence from youth. And although the focus is not on post-traumatic stress disorder, we're talking here about the prevention of anxiety and depression. And given that depression is both a common risk factor for post-traumatic stress disorder and a very common response to trauma, I hope that this talk will be of relevance to the prevention of post-traumatic stress disorder as well. So the first part of my argument there is that prevention is effective. And I'm just going to go through a couple of points here that the definition of prevention, challenges in undertaking prevention research, and then looking at the effectiveness of prevention research. Because I think there is a scepticism in the minds of many people about whether prevention can actually work. And I want to kind of argue that this can be dispelled on the basis of the evidence. So I apologise for people who know about prevention. I just wanted to go over the definitions of prevention here. These are Mrazek and Haggerty's very influential description of prevention and its definitions. So we have universal prevention, which is an attempt to target the whole population in order to reduce the incidence of the development of a new case of, say, anxiety and depression. So you target the whole population. Second type of prevention is selective, where you choose a particular factor or feature that might put people at risk of developing disorders. So, for example, in the case of trauma, if they were located in New York, in particular areas of New York, prior to 9/11, or if you're looking at particular characteristics of people, if they come from a family where the parents, say, have depression. And now indicator prevention is really looking at targeting those individuals who show symptoms already of a particular disorder. For example, people might have highly elevated anxiety and depression symptoms but do not meet formal criteria for depression. Now the concept of early intervention is defined very differently, but most people consider early intervention as something that happens very close to when the person starts to develop symptoms. And if there isn't a diagnosis and a sub-threshold at that point, early intervention can look very similar to indicated prevention. So, we're interested in preventing mental health problems, and I just wanted to point out a number of the problems we have in actually trying to demonstrate that prevention does work. First of all, genuine prevention trials require huge numbers of people in order to be able to demonstrate effects. For example, anxiety, the prevalence of anxiety or new incident cases of anxiety might be only 2% per year. So if you wish to translate that into trying to demonstrate an effect, you need hundreds of thousands of people really to be involved in very large-scale prevention trials. That's particularly the case if you want to test different types of prevention interventions, because you're looking for tiny differences between the offsetting of what is, in fact, a very low case rate. The second problem is that we really don't know how to do prevention yet. There's not much clear evidence of whether we should be doing universal, selective, or indicated. And some very nice work's been done at the Trimbos Institute by Smith and others, Philip Smith, looking at what are the best approaches to prevention and which way should we be going. And one of the conclusions he makes in this paper, or a number of papers that he's written, is that perhaps indicated prevention may in fact be the most likely approach one can take in order to prevent the development of disorder in a population. A third challenge is one that I think has been many people at this conference have been talking about, and that is the problem of engagement. I mean, even if you develop an effective prevention program, what is it going to make people want to do that program? How we are going to engage people in the process? And we have a similar problem here with people who even have diagnosed illness, something like maybe 40% of people with a diagnosed level of depression do not seek help. And for anxiety, it might be something like 74%. So we have a problem even in people who have, if you like, a pretty good reason to want to be engaged in treatment, in that we don't actually engage people very well in treatment. And it's probably not going to be very different in prevention. In fact, it's probably going to be harder in prevention because the person isn't driven by their feelings of unhappiness and disorder. Now, there are a number of approaches that are being taken to engagement, including what we heard last night about making Second Life and other virtual environments attractive to bring people into them. There's other things like stigma reduction programs, providing good feedback, setting up screening programs online and so on. And indeed one that might in fact prove itself to be an excellent way of engaging people is to actually prescribe prevention. So make it a requirement, for example, in schools that people are taught prevention of anxiety and depression. So leaving it really up to, it's a sort of seatbelt approach, you know, you actually have to do it. And finally, there are individual differences. We don't know why some people might respond to prevention and others not. And of course, we have the problem of chronic anxiety and depression. These are not disorders that are just a single episode. They repeat themselves, and it's likely that a prevention might in fact have to be a lifelong process, just as managing depression symptoms may be like that for many people who have depression and anxiety. So, having all that said, all of that, I just want to argue now that in fact some work is very clearly indicating in youth that prevention programs do work in reducing anxiety and depression, and indeed in preventing illness. Alison Kalira and myself have just reviewed all of the school-based programs for anxiety and depression prevention. We did a systematic review of randomized controlled trials for depression and randomized controlled trials of all forms of prevention research for anxiety. And what we came up with was that both universal and indicated programs do have about a 50% chance of showing a positive effect in schools, and that indicated may be better for depression, but for anxiety, universal programs seem to be as effective as indicated programs. And most of these programs are based on cognitive behaviour therapy. We also reviewed non-school-based programs for youth and found that the rate of success of these programs was around about 60%, indicating that at least in more than half of the prevention trials that have been undertaken, there are positive findings. So, in short, the evidence is strong enough to support continued use of universal prevention programs and indicated prevention programs in youth, although the evidence needs strengthening through the conduct of genuine prevention trials. And many of these trials have very low numbers, so it's difficult to establish effects. And many of these studies did not exclude people who had anxiety and depression disorders. Now, one of the key things about prevention is that a lot of the findings might be driven by those clinical cases in the sample who are making changes in response to treatment. And one of the challenges in genuine prevention trials is to take out people who have disorder. The other finding, though, is that cognitive behaviour therapy interventions are those that predominate in these research trials, and more likely than not, they are delivered by health professionals in classroom settings. So we have one of the major practical problems of any sort of intervention, and that is how can we, with the limited numbers of health professionals we have, offer universal prevention programs in our schools if we don't have the workforce numbers to be able to do it? So we have the challenge of feasibility and implementation of what might prove to be effective prevention. So this brings me to the second level of the argument that I wanted to present today, which is to argue that prevention is feasible at a population level using web platforms. And the first obvious thing is to actually show that web-delivered prevention programs are effective. To this point, I've described most of the studies which are non-web-based but do give certain strength to the idea that prevention is likely to be beneficial. Now, there's indirect evidence that web-based prevention programs will work. We know, and I'm sure we'll hear from Gerard about web-based intervention treatments. There's probably something like 40 randomised controlled trials now showing that web-based interventions, whether guided, self-help based, or in conjunction with a therapist, are effective. So this gives some hope that prevention programs might have the same effect. Secondly, a couple of the non-school-based programs that I just described are computer-based. And as we know, the power of the internet is that you can harness a computer to a browser and get the same sorts of effects. So again, this is an indirect evidence that a computer-based program is effective for prevention, and there's research to support that. But now I'm really pleased to say there is now some emerging direct evidence of web-delivered prevention programs being effective. And I'll just briefly describe, there's only four or five of these studies. First of all, early research indicated the usefulness of web approaches to prevention in youth. Justin Canardi from the University of Queensland showed that if you targeted people with anxiety sensitivity, then you got changes in their in their anxiety symptoms. This was a university study. An unfortunate feature was that people with diagnosis weren't excluded. So there's a question mark really about whether how genuine the prevention was. We've also done two trials in schools. Richard O'Kearney and other members of our team found that web-based prevention using Mood Gym in schools was effective, but these trials were not randomised controlled trials. There's been a recent report of a classroom workshop supported by web materials. Martin Seligman's study showed positive outcomes at 6 months using web-supported group treatment. Again, this isn't really going to do much at a mass level. It's a very good study and so on, but because it's part of a group program, the scalability of it is questionable. And another study that has been done by Benjamin Van Vuhes, who is here, I think, and going to present this afternoon, is another example of a very recent study where a web-based program has been used in primary care and supplemented with either motivational interviewing or advice in a general practice environment, and he found effects of both those interventions. So this again supports the use of web-based programs for prevention. But what I'd like to report today is a study that we've now done in schools in Australia using our Mood Gym program, which is an automatised web-based program. And our particular aim was to give this to classroom teachers. The teachers did nothing except have the kids do the program on the internet, and so we're working towards an effectiveness study here and showing that it didn't require the actions of either the teachers or a health professional for this program to be effective if it was going to be effective. And this is a major issue in all these mental health programs in schools, which is that the teachers, if they're not trained in psychology, have a very strong reluctance to deliver what they see as a psychological program to their students without training. Mood Gym is a site that people have talked about here, which is good, and basically it was developed in 2001, and people go, they register, they meet characters online, it tries to be very normalising. It's not really about mental health, it's about improving the way you cope. People fill in different questionnaires and they progress through 5 modules of the program. It's got interactive flash diagrams. At the end of each session they get a printout saying how they went, what their major areas might be of where they might need to improve their dysfunctional thinking, or what we call warpy thoughts in the program. This is warp 2. And all the graphics and so on were actually designed by graphic arts students aged about 20 at another university very close to us. So it was quite interesting working with young people to develop the site, because I think we were trying to make it something that it would appeal to them, and the capabilities of the graphic designers, I think, helped to make it at least attractive for young people to do. People do various assessments online. They're provided with feedback about where the areas of vulnerability might be. They have a workbook with 28 exercises. It's very CBT-based, but with problem-solving and other stress management techniques. And they're given feedback as they progress through the modules about where they are. So it sits on behind a firewall within the centre. We can have open access users. It's open and free across globally and always has been. We can invite people to join us on trials where they're randomized to different components of the program, for example. And we also have relationships with other people doing research on the internet, so we might have 3 or 4 or 5 studies being conducted around the world simultaneously. And the software behind the site allows us to do that. It's been expanded to another site called eCouch, and Moojim has actually been subsumed into this new software. And previous research has shown in the treatment of people with high symptoms in the community aged between 18 and 50, we have efficacy for the site. So what we're doing here is putting this site, which has a level of efficacy for treatment, into a prevention environment and giving it to all the students within a set of schools. So we had 30 schools. The age of the students was around about 14. They were assessed pencil and paper during the course of the intervention, and basically we got consent. The schools were randomised, so we had 15 in group A and 15 in group B. And the first group, we did it across a year, so the first group got Moojim. They completed post-intervention a few weeks after completing the 5-week course, and then they had a 6-month follow-up, and we compared that to the other schools who then, after 6 months, were provided with the Moojim program. And data was analysed. We looked at inter-class correlations, which were minimal within the classrooms, and so we used an intention-to-treat analysis to look at the effects. So now what I'm going to describe are the results of the universal intervention, that is, what effect did it have on symptoms of students who did Moojim compared to non-Moojim. And these are the girls, high symptoms, and these are the boys, these two lower graphs here. And basically these are the ones who got the Moojim program in dotted lines, and these are the ones who didn't. And what we found was that at 6 months, there's a significant reduction in depression scores for males, but not for females. So the effect on depression was specific to males and not to females as a result of the prevention program. If you look at anxiety, we got an effect on both, for both girls and boys, of this program doing it in the classroom. Now, the question then becomes, okay, that's a universal, but what about kids we know who don't even have symptoms? What happens to them if you give them the program? Or they don't have symptoms that would meet a level that might be classed as a case. And what we did in the next part of the program was to take out anyone who had high symptoms on the scales, so the definitely sub-threshold, and all the normal kids are left. And we got exactly the same effect. So this is boys again. If they do the Moojim program, then they don't have high SSD and it decreases slightly. If they don't do the program, then you get this increase in depression across the 6-month period. And this is the girls. There's no difference whether they do the program or not. But interestingly, I think the levels of anxiety and depression do increase or have been increasing and do increase in this age group across time. So in a way, I think it's a good time to intervene if we're going to do the programs. For anxiety, for both groups, those who did the Moojim program had a significant reduction in their anxiety symptoms, even if you exclude kids who don't have symptoms or don't have high symptoms at the beginning of the program. Now, I just wanted to point here to the intention to treat. For men, young men, the intention to treat, number needed to treat in order to prevent a case, it's 14, which from one perspective people think, well, gee, that looks, you've got to treat 14 people in order to avoid one of them getting a prevention, in developing symptoms. But in effect, this means if we do this in our classrooms, every time we do a classroom of boys, we're avoiding the development of depression in 2 young men. So when you look at it from a public health point of view, it actually becomes quite a significant thing to be doing, I think, anyway. Okay, having established then, I think, a level of knowledge that suggests that we can do prevention, we can automate it, we can do it in classrooms. Let's look at what the web now gives us in terms of being able to feasibly and practically deliver it. So first of all, dissemination. And we've talked about this too with post-traumatic stress disorder and other things. The internet allows a program like MooGym to be disseminated globally. And in fact, this is the data on MooGym. The colours in white are countries that have not accessed the program. So what we have is 204 countries around the world, all parts of the world, where we have record of access by people for using the program. So I think this isn't so much about MooGym, this is about the feasibility of having something that can be delivered on a mass scale. And if you look at the countries, it's interesting as well. This is Australia, where it's quite well known. This is US commercial. This is sort of undifferentiated. This is the UK, and indeed one of the highest areas where people come to use the site in the UK is from the National Health Service, because it's free, and other computerised interventions to deliver cognitive therapy cost the trust money. And then this is Canada, pleased to say, comes in there as at least one of the countries that's using the program. So we know we can disseminate it using a web. We can also understand why web-delivered interventions like this are cost-effective. And we did a cost-effectiveness analysis of our treatment program, MooGym. It was done by Professor Jim Butler from the Australian National University. And I think this is interesting because it actually clearly shows why web-based dissemination is cheap. What we did was compare a person who might have depression with the costs of what MooGym CBT might be compared to if they go to the general practitioner, where they might be offered antidepressant medication or they might be referred to a psychologist for cognitive behaviour therapy. And in this model, we assume that of the comparators of MooGym, which is what we're talking about here, is person-delivered antidepressant medication or person-delivered cognitive behaviour therapy, the cost of the therapy is assumed to be constant and independent of the number of patients treated. So it still costs the same. Each person that comes along, it still costs the same for a psychologist to deliver that on a one-to-one basis. But if you look at the financial relationship between the development of a website and its cost, you can argue that the cost function is more shaped like this, that as the number of people who use the website increases, the unit cost per person for the delivery of the intervention is much lower per person. So you have high development costs for the development of web-based interventions, but as people more and more use it, the cost per unit user drops, whereas the cost per person for psychology or for general practice is the same cost per person. And that's how drug companies like to work as well. You know, the cost of the antidepressant is still the same cost per person the government pays or the person pays. So Jim Butler looked at how many people do you have to see using MooGym in order for it to break even relative to a psychologist giving CBT or to the use of antidepressant medication. And the results were for the number of people that you need to see in order to offset the cost of general practice, 359, whereas the cost is greater for a psychologist with CBT, it might be. You need to do 753 people in order for the cost of the development of the website to be offset. And the throughput, of course, of MooGym is now 300,000 people, so the actual unit cost of person on the website is so much less than the actual cost of the people. So it's like making DVDs or something. Once you've done the development costs, you just kind of print them out, and they cost a few cents each. So we now know that they can be effective using the web, that they're capable of dissemination, that the cost ratio there is going to likely to be quite inexpensive. And then there are another set of characteristics of web-based interventions that make it even more appealing as a way of developing mass prevention. And these are things about engagement, tailoring, connectivity, evaluation, adherence, and what you actually get as you keep developing these websites. So just briefly say a little bit about these features of the web that make it more attractive than, for example, other effective means such as sending out coping with depression books or other forms of bibliotherapy that perhaps have the potential here as well. The first one is engagement, and I think we saw that last night with sites like Second Life. Once individuals connect to a website and register, it may be possible to reconnect to encourage help seeking. So if trust can be established, the internet website becomes a portal to services and can offer proactive reach out. This needs more research, but just to give you an example of a study that we did, which resonated with a number of studies other people have done as well, in help seeking. And what we did in this particular study was to use electronic e-health cards, which we sent to people, members of the general public, and tried to engage with them about information about depression and anxiety, and then looked to see whether they changed their attitude towards help seeking, or indeed their attitude towards the researcher who sent them the e-cards. So this was a large trial that we approached 12,000 individuals using the Australian electoral roll, which is pretty representative of the population. We screened them, and those who had symptoms we selected for involvement in the trial, as well as for some who didn't have symptoms, because we were interested not only in those who have symptoms who might need help, but people who don't, who might try and guide other people with symptoms to seek help. It's a big trial. I won't go into it in too much detail, but basically people are randomised to two interventions. We've got these two cohorts, those with symptoms and those without. We randomised them to three different conditions. We gave them a basic condition where they got health information about depression and anxiety, where to get help, attitudes to help seeking and so on, and how to connect with psychologists and counsellors. The enhanced was more of the same rather than very brief information. And finally, the control was information of interest to young people without a mental health focus, so, for example, meningococcal disease and so on. Now, the two conditions, the basic and the enhanced, didn't show any difference, so I'm just combining those two together for a discussion. That's just to give you an idea of what the e-health cards look like. They're just sent out with the ANU logo and so on. People unsolicited get these. Oh, sorry, after the screening they get them once they agree to be part of the health study. Now, the point was we didn't find any differences really at all between the conditions that we had in terms of people's changing views about symptoms and knowledge about depression or about their attitudes to help seeking. Except in one case, and it could have been just a type one error, but what we did find was that the intervention, those who got the basic or enhanced condition, were more likely to know what clinical psychologists did. Actually, the person from the APA might be interested to know that people's attitudes to psychologists are very negative, and this actually might be one way to improve people's way of engaging with psychologists, because they would much prefer to engage with a counsellor than a psychologist. So the information did change their attitudes to whether they'd seek help from a psychologist. But there were no differences. And in a way, you think, well, this is a failed trial. However, even though we couldn't find any differences, what we did find was that the whole sample shifted in its attitude to help seeking. So whether it was engagement with the researcher or the fact that people were given some information and found it sort of useful, what we found was that there was quite a massive change in people's perception that they would actually help sick if they needed to. So I think that's very interesting. I don't think it's necessarily a negative thing. And the point is, this was all automated, can all be sent out, and if it's true that any sort of intervention changes people's perception about the value of help seeking with a connection to us, I think that's a good outcome. The other advantage of the web is, and I talked about this yesterday, is really that we can test whether tailoring information to people improves the efficacy of our interventions. We can improve the fidelity of the intervention that we provide because, as we know, therapist intervention can sometimes be changeable. I'm not saying this is better than a therapist, but obviously the fidelity of what you offer doesn't change. And we have a new site called eCouch, which has been particularly developed in order to test whether tailoring and targeting is going to be a more effective way of intervening in both treatment and prevention. And it's freely available on the web now if you want to go and have a look at it. We're very careful about how people use it, what we offer, the privacy involvement of it. It's when people come to register, we find out about their symptoms, and then we can tailor and target different programs in the future to their particular symptom profile. We assess them on a variety of sort of screening instruments, and we've just developed one of the modules that actually offers, rather than just CBT, interpersonal psychotherapy we can now provide over the internet. And we're looking forward to seeing whether that's an effective intervention used through the web as well. Okay, another advantage of web-based platforms is that they promote connectivity, they allow tracking, and they can be used to deliver follow-up emails in an automated way. The internet also allows you to put software around the behaviour of your users, collect information from them, so you can do automatic reports on what's happening to the people who are using your site. We can also study adherence, which is a very important problematic aspect of almost all interventions, very easily. And I don't have time to explain, but basically because you have real behaviour of people, what they actually do with an intervention, it provides a great platform for studying adherence. And finally, we can develop databases as we go along of all the people who come to our site and develop predictive models of health. So, just go back to summarise. What I've argued is that prevention programs do work and that we now have evidence that prevention on the web can be effective, and that there is also evidence that the unique features of the web make it a truly possible way of actually delivering mass prevention at a scale that previously would have been very difficult to do. And what does this all have to do with post-traumatic stress disorder? Well, I suppose if I was a public health person working about how the internet could be used, not working in PTSD, I guess I would be saying that we could do universal prevention interventions before trauma happens. And I guess people don't... I guess the point of what I've said here is that it's actually feasible to do this now. So it could be protecting our population at a particular point from the risk factor of depression symptoms in order to avoid the effects of trauma. And I know other people are going to be talking about this over the conference, but of course we have self-screening and engagement. We have indicated prevention after trauma. We can do specialised PTDS sites, which are now being developed, which offer early intervention and which provide portals into face-to-face therapy and connections to specialist assessment and specialist clinics. So I'd just like to finish by saying thank you very much for listening to the presentation, and I'll end there. Thank you.
We will now have a question period for Dr. Christensen.
Yes.
Dr. Christensen, I wonder if you could speculate a little about the differential response of boys and girls in one of the studies, presents so many wonderful studies, and what you thought might be the origin of that in a classroom study.
Yeah, I think young men have difficulty expressing their feelings and emotions more than young women do. And so I think that's one factor. The second factor is that we see that young women talk to each other and offer advice and help about how to cope with various anxiety and depression problems. And one of the other studies we've shown that by delivering health information, you can actually get young people, both men and women, to stop listening to advice, which can often be counterproductive. And one of those sorts of advices that young women seem to do to each other is sort of protect each other from, say, exposing themselves to speaking in public, or, oh yes, poor you, no, you don't have to do it, oh, it's terrible, blah. And they don't actually, they may be protective of the young women in actually exposing themselves to potential areas of intervention. But that's all I know. Yeah, oh, sorry.
First of all, I just want to let you know that I discovered Mujem a few years ago, and I actually put a link on our clinic website up to it, and we got some very positive feedback, and I do think it's a great tool. So,
thank you.
My question, though, is about the cost comparison data that you presented on that chart about halfway through. And I was a bit confused. You seem to be comparing the production cost of the website to the consumption cost of drugs, which are different things.
Drugs delivered by a general practitioner.
But you were comparing the cost of producing the website to the cost of consuming the drugs, whereas in fact...
Yeah, cost of the service of providing the drugs to the individual, which incorporates having to meet with the general practitioner and being followed up. So the costs of the doctor prescribing the drug in the clinic setting are factored into that.
Yeah, I guess that, well, I haven't read your paper, of course, and I don't work for a drug company. but it did seem that you were comparing two different things, though, and that it wasn't clearly you weren't comparing production costs. You were comparing
I appreciate, and I think it's a very interesting issue, that cost thing, because I appreciate that drugs have a similar developmental profile to the development of a website. However, when they're provided to an individual, the direct cost the individual pays is the same unit price. So you always pay X amount of dollars for the delivery of the drugs, even though the actual costs are different. And actually what it made me think was that if you were really going to make money out of a website, what you do is pay per unit cost. You know, I mean, I take your point that drugs have a similar profile, but in the case of this cost effectiveness analysis, as I say, you can't get them without having the service personnel put into it, and each person needs that very costly service personnel to put in. But I mean, I guess my other point is that if you're buying a service or developing something like this and you want to make money from it as a developer, you pay per unit cost of person, because you'll be a very rich person presumably after the thing, as drug companies are.
This is really, really wonderful work. I want to know a lot more about it. About the Mood Gym, though, how much time does it actually take for somebody to do the program? Is it individualized? You mentioned it was CBT-based. Could you just describe a little bit more? We saw a questionnaire, but then what does the treatment look like?
It's like an e-learning program, but very interactive. So the person fills in, they respond to it, they do the exercises. It's individual, and in certain parts of it are tailored. So if they have, say, particular warpy thoughts about the need to be loved, then they'll be shifted to that part of the program that addresses that sort of difficulty. It takes, I don't know, it varies, but you can deliver it like in half-hour blocks. Each module's half an hour, so I guess over 2.5 hours for the delivery of the program.
the maximum time somebody would spend would be 2.5 hours, less if they have fewer symptoms?
Well, basically people work through the same program, but they just get individualized feedback. But we have done studies where we've broken it down and tested which components are more effective. And essentially you can get the same effects if you have 2 to 3 modules of the program, as long as they are the ones that contain the extended CBT part.
2.5 hours is the maximum.
Okay. Yeah, sorry.
Hi. That was a wonderful talk.
Oh, thank you.
I just have a quick comment and then a question. My comment about your research on the costs, I think it's wonderful that you did that analysis, but knowing that the average cost to create and market an antidepressant costs over $1 billion, I can definitely tell you that your project is much more cost effective. That's for one antidepressant. And that doesn't include all the drug dinners that the pharmaceutical reps try and entice us to go to. Now, my question is actually about interpersonal psychotherapy. I'm really glad that you're incorporating that, because as a clinician, I find IPT a better fit for me than CBT.
Yeah.
Could you please comment a bit more on how you're doing that in your program?
Okay, well, it's a bit paradoxical to do IPT over the net with a machine, you know, an algorithm on the other end, but that module I wrote using Weissman's handbook and just tried to develop the 4 components about grief and social skills and so on. And most of it is like the CBT type thing, you know, challenging people. But there are sections of it where we have you saw the people sitting together, that's a voice thing, and there is a made-up interaction between the therapist and the person. And we are evaluating, I'm not actually evaluating it, a PhD student from VU University, Tara Donker. We're doing an online automated trial to compare that with CBT and with mood gym as a control condition, to see whether it's going to be working as a component as well as a CBT component. Yeah, Ben.
I have the microphone.
Oh, sorry. I didn't see.
Well, I think we should both have the question.
I'm
a
sorry.
Short question, very impressive, of course, like concerning mood gym. Did you discuss the issue of one of the big issues for young people, suicidal attempts, suicidal rates? Did you kind of get into that, in which way this would affect suicidal attempts and suicidal rates epidemiologically? As a human, as a public health problem?
Well, we, in our assessments, we, because it's an automated program, and for whatever reason, we do not ask questions about their suicidal ideation because of various things to do with risk and knowing risk factors. I mean, that isn't putting our head in the sand, because we've tried similar programs to this in crisis intervention centres, where we do actually ask about risk and try and see whether that this sort of intervention reduces suicide risk. But I think this is designed as prevention, early intervention, and it's not designed. That doesn't mean you don't have the obligations of looking after people who are at risk, and we have a whole service behind. If people send us an email in distress, we organise for them to be connected to services and so on.
Quick question. Since we're sitting in a psychiatric hospital in Michitik of Milieu, I'm wondering, in this intervention, the classroom intervention, you talked about the boys and the girls, whether there was a change, and I know you guys have published about the first aid for mental health, and the kind of first aid that students were offering each other, that there would be almost an entire classroom effect of changing the culture around which students might offer first aid to one another based on learning more evidence-based techniques of what would be appropriate to redress, to say, a negative mood state.
Sure. The evidence that I was talking about for changing people's perception of the usefulness of talking to friends was data that came from our original research trial, but the data that we have as well from the students is that when you give them these information about what works and what doesn't work for helping with anxiety and depression, then you do get these changes in the level of their seeking, their self-report that they seek help from their friends. So I think it's a really important issue, which I can't really say anything more about. But I mean, obviously, it's the way to go, I think, to try and not so much necessarily promote positive behaviour sometimes, but actually stop behaviour that is negatively impacting on people normally exposing themselves to, say, social anxiety situations. Okay, thank you.